Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. 1.5 million North Carolinians live in poverty. 650,000 of them live in extreme poverty, and a third of them are children, 5 years old and younger. Now, most of us don't think about these people. In fact, our guest calls them invisible. That invisibility allows the luxury of a number of preconceived notions about the poor to continue. You might believe that they are loafers, drug addicts, or people who suffer from mental illness. And some of them are, but not all. Many hold down full-time jobs, others multiple part-time jobs, and still can't make ends meet, still can't feed or properly house their families, can't afford medical care. Gene Nickel is the Boyd Tinsley Distinguished Professor of Law at UNC Chapel Hill. For much of his career, he has been traveling the state, talking to the poor, hearing the stories of their lives, and he tells those stories in his book, The Faces of Poverty in North Carolina, Stories from Our Invisible Citizens. And for the remainder of the hour, Gene Nickel shares some of those stories and other things he's learned with us from the studios at the UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome to the program. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mike. Glad to be here.
You begin your book by reminding us that our founding documents refer to our equality, but then you say we talk a great game, but what we do has little in common with what we say because the statistics of American poverty are straightforward and demoralizing. 40 million Americans fall below the poverty line. Has this always been the case, or is this a recent phenomenon?
Well, it's been the case often throughout our history, sometimes even more bleakly than it is now. But it's also true that we have, in a powerful way, lost a good bit of ground in terms of the existence of poverty amidst plenty, which is our great challenge, since perhaps the mid-70s. So it's a very challenging problem now. I think our largest one, you know, when you think about it, we're the richest nation on earth by far, and yet compared to all our peer nations, we have the highest poverty rates and certainly the highest child poverty rates. So in some sense, we become the richest, the poorest, and the most unequal of nations, and that's not what we brag about.
How do you explain that?
I think a lot of it is policy-based. A lot of it is structural. A lot of it has to do with economic trends, which we've suffered a good deal from in North Carolina, yeah. The internationalization, the NAFTA issues. And a lot of it is that poverty is invisible to many of us. I'm inclined not to think that the United States is the most selfish or greedy of nations, that we care less about low-income folks than other major countries. But some of it is that for a lot of us, poverty is invisible. It doesn't occur in our direct vision, in our neighborhoods. It's on the other side of town, the other side of the county. And so we can ignore it. We can look to more congenial atmospherics, still believe this is the fairest nation in the world, even though the facts don't bear that out. Yeah. I'll give you an example. We've done quite a bit of work with, I think, as you know, Crisis Assistance Ministry in Charlotte. When we first started going down there, I had a long discussion with an AmeriCorps volunteer who was doing some work at Crisis Ministries. She indicated that she had gone to the dentist a couple days before, and he had, as dentists will sometimes do, especially when you got stuff in your mouth, he asked what she did for a living, and she said she worked for AmeriCorps, the poverty program, and he said, well, what are you doing in Charlotte? There's no poverty here. I've lived here all my life, and if there were poor people here, I would know about it. So aren't you misplaced? I think she invited him to come down and visit with some of the 200 or so folks in line at Crisis Ministries the next morning, but he probably didn't come.
Well, two questions about this. If does invisibility, does the invisibility of these people allow us, has it allowed the problem to get worse and worse and worse over time because we simply don't see it? That's the average rank and file, perhaps, who doesn't see it. But certainly policymakers are aware of it. Tax collectors are aware of it. Sheriffs are aware of it. Health services are aware of it. Why? How can they possibly be invisible?
Well, I think you're right in a powerful way. When we interviewed low-income folks in Charlotte, they said the homelessness challenges, for example, that exist in Charlotte that have gotten a good deal of attention, it can't be that people don't know about those in real terms. But we've also changed our politics somewhat. This is no great secret. It is clearly the case that in North Carolina, our General Assembly, clearly in the last, much of the last decade, but also powerfully before that too, has come first to ignore the plight of low-income people, and then in the last 7 or 8 years, we've begun to target low-income people for public policies that certainly don't ease their plight, likely make it more difficult. So we have made choices about this. It's also true in the United States, as you know, in Charlotte as well, that race and poverty are hand in glove, and they have been for generations and centuries. And so you put together this troubling stew, and we have a great challenge.
You reference, as I mentioned at the very beginning, our founding documents and some of the phraseology that goes along with them, that all men are created equal. Though very American, that phrase, it certainly isn't true. What that American idea dictates should be true is that we all get an equal shot, and clearly we don't. But is that even possible?
Well, it's certainly possible to do much better than we are right now. All men are created equal. All folks are meant to have equal opportunities and equal dignity. Now, you know of the great international inequality scholar Thomas Piketty. He wrote last year that the United States right now has probably higher inequality, economic inequality, than any other society at any time in the past anywhere in the world. So it may be that we can't be perfect, but we don't have to be the worst that the planet has ever seen either. And that's where we seemingly reside right now.
Gene Nickel has written this book called The Faces of Poverty in North Carolina, and he worked for years along with students for the UNC Center of Poverty, which I believe is now closed, if I'm not mistaken, because of decisions by the board of directors or the Board of Governors at the university. But as part of that work, it was to meet and talk with, humanize, and put a face on these people who live in poverty around our state. Where are the worst pockets of poverty?
You know, this is one of the things that we began to learn, kind of contrary to the general received wisdom, 10 or 12 years ago. We accurately think of poverty on a rural-urban axis in North Carolina. And that's true. We think we have these powerful urban areas, Charlotte, the Triangle, the Triad. By the same token, in rural areas, particularly in eastern North Carolina, somewhat in western North Carolina, we have long-standing, multi-generational, persistent poverty which has plagued us. So we think of poverty on a rural-urban axis, and that's not inaccurate. We have gigantic rural poverty problems. But when you pierce below county averages, for example, and we started doing this some years ago, and you look at census tracts, which are closer to neighborhoods, you see that ironically, the deepest poverty in North Carolina is right in the middle of Charlotte, Durham, Greensboro, Winston-Salem, and Wake County. That's not the way we look at it. It's not the way we think of it. But nobody's going to think of Mecklenburg County as a poor county or a, what we think of in North Carolina as a tier one county. But that's because averages can be deceiving. So the deepest poverty in North Carolina, you've got a good chunk of right in Mecklenburg County.
Why is that? Is that because the cost of living in the urban areas of North Carolina is more expensive than it would be in the rural areas, or is there something else at work there?
That is certainly part of it. And you know, I don't want to keep going back to Charlotte, but this is Charlotte. You know, in Charlotte, there's been much attention in the last 3 or 4 years to challenges of mobility. Mm-hmm. Charlotte ends up 50th. on this national study, 50th out of 50, which is not what anyone in Charlotte expects or wants or is satisfied with. But when you look at the challenges of mobility, it's directly related to poverty, to high levels of income inequality, to racial segregation, and to inequality in the educational scheme. So given that set of conditions, it's unsurprising that you're going to find great poverty and economic challenge even in Mecklenburg County, which has so much economic prowess.
But as you studied the state, what you find out is that this is both a black and a white problem. You write about Goldsboro, which is 60 miles southeast of Raleigh in Wayne County. It's the fifth poorest city in America. I didn't know that. 25% of its residents live in poverty. You also write about Wilkes County, about 30 minutes from Boone. You describe it as ravaged by NAFTA. 25% of its residents live in poverty. In Wilkes, the area is blanketed, you say, by Confederate flags and Trump signs. None of those exist in Wayne County, which is primarily black. And you say they consider themselves political and cultural adversaries, but their fears and aspirations follow nearly identical paths. Explain that.
Well, now, first of all, let me just indicate something which you just suggested, which points at part of the problem. You haven't heard of Goldsboro's unwelcome prowess as one of the four or five poorest cities in the country. You might not have heard of Greensboro's regular acclaim at being the hungriest city in the United States. We're spending a lot of time right now in High Point, North Carolina. The High Point Greensboro metropolitan area has typically the greatest food insecurity, the federal government teaches us, in the United States. I don't ever hear any political leaders talking about that. I don't hear any political leaders talking about the depth of poverty in Goldsboro. There's never any discussion of poverty in the North Carolina General Assembly in the first place. We talk about all our rankings and the like. We tend never to mention that, you know, North Carolina is one of the very toughest places for childhood hunger. Hungry babies, we are among the worst. Now, that's all a preface to what you asked me about, which is Wilkes on the one hand, which is almost all white and suffers intense poverty. Goldsboro, last year or 2 years ago, we spent about a year, some of my students and I, going regularly to low-income housing projects in Goldsboro, interviewing folks, which was sort of a horrifying experience in some ways. We have North Carolinians who live in virtual terror because of the danger in their housing surrounds. And at the same time, we spent many months interviewing low-income folks in Wilkes. Two very different cultural experiences. Mm-hmm. Usually in Wilkes, we would be talking to people in 40 or 50-year-old trailers. And as you said, outside there might be a Confederate flag and a Trump sign. In Goldsboro, as opposed to broader Wayne County, I should say, in Goldsboro itself, the city, you certainly weren't going to be seeing any Trump signs, and most of the folks we were talking to in low-income projects were black and Latino. Those two groups would not have considered themselves cultural allies. But when we interviewed them and we talked about what their fears were, what their needs were, what they wished for their kids, who they trusted to help them out, what sort of programs they thought might be congenial, the answers were almost the same, you know, from both communities. So what I tell people is, if anyone was ever smart enough to realize, or to help us realize, to help those folks in Wayne County realize how much they have in common with the people in Wilkes County, then you could fix our politics. You could fix it powerfully.
But
I'm not smart enough to do that. You
said a moment ago that scarcely a word about poverty is uttered in the General Assembly, and also you say in the book that recent North Carolina governors have almost never mentioned it, regardless of political party. Is that because they're embarrassed by it? Or is it because they believe systems of help are in place and working? Is it because they believe the poor are laggards? Why? Why is it never talked about?
I think it's because poor people are not seen as part of the relevant constituency.
But they vote?
They vote. They don't vote as much as we could wish they voted, but they don't hang out with gubernatorial candidates. They don't host fundraisers. They're not active in the politics of either party. They are mostly marginalized. We have a long history in North Carolina, probably since the days of Terry Sanford and the North Carolina Fund, of Democrats ignoring poor people. That's been true of legislators. It's been true of governors. We've learned in the last 7 years, that there's one thing worse than government officials ignoring poor people. You can target poor people and overtly take steps to make life more difficult for them. But neither of those are formulas, either ignoring poor people or targeting poor people. They're not formulas for solving what is our greatest challenge of inequality.
So we only have about a minute left in this segment, but you say that you said repeatedly this morning that we treat poor people poorly. But we do provide government assistance. Charitable organizations jump in and fill similar functions. Is North Carolina, is the United States doing a substantially worse job in helping the poor where they are?
Yes. We have greater levels of poverty, greater levels of child poverty than the other advanced Western democracies. The people tend to use the comparisons of about 38 advanced Western nations. We have more poverty, more inequality, and we have weaker programs to try and alleviate it than virtually all of our peers.
Gene Nickel is a professor of law at UNC Chapel Hill and the author of The Faces of Poverty in North Carolina, Stories from Our Invisible Citizens. When we come back, we'll make them less so. We'll put a face on these folks and what he has learned about who they are. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Gene Nickel joins us, a distinguished professor of law at UNC Chapel Hill, the author of The Faces of Poverty in North Carolina, Stories from Our Invisible Citizens. The stereotypes of the poor as being lazy or strung out on drugs or suffering from mental illness isn't completely true. Would you say that most of the people are not that?
Yes.
Okay.
Far and away, most of the people are not that. And a very large chunk of them are not only not that, but they're heroic, tremendously strong and resilient, committed to their families, facing challenges which would cripple me and maybe not you, Mike, but a lot of us. So
So who are these people? I mean, what are their lives like? Why are they in that situation?
Yeah. Let me say first, that has a lot to do with why I've written this book. I've thought a good bit about poverty over the years. I've spent a whole lot of time in low-income communities. But the most effective way of getting at that, I think, of describing that, is to interview people and use their own descriptions of the challenges that they face. It's one thing to have a lot of data to talk, as we have, about 1.5 million Tar Heels living in poverty, or nearly 20% of us being food insecure. But if you're inclined to ignore that, then the difference between 18% of people living in poverty and 14% living in poverty is not going to move you one way or another. I've thought this, what might move you is narrative, the description, largely out of low-income folks' mouths, of the challenges that they face, what they seek to do, how they help to support their families, what it means, for example, not to be able to get health care, what it means to see your mother die because Medicaid wasn't expanded and she couldn't get necessary health care coverage. Those are much more wrenching depictions. And so my thought is you need both. You need narrative to help people understand the plight that their brothers and sisters face, which would surprise them. But if you only had narrative, then people will say, well, okay, you ran into three or four people who are having, or 300 or 400 people who are having a hard time of it, but they probably deserve it, and that's idiosyncratic. Mm. So you need the data. The data suggests how overarching and pervasive it is. In North Carolina, for example, we are one of the most economically vibrant states of the richest nation on earth, and yet we have astonishing levels of poverty. Over a quarter of our kids, almost 40% of our children of color live in poverty. And yet we almost never talk about it. That's astonishing, it seems to me.
And you write that a lot of these people work full-time jobs. You point out that one familiar story is that many are limited to working 30 hours a week in that full-time job, because if they work 30 hours a week, then they won't be eligible for health benefits. That sounds deliberate and cruel. Is it? It's certainly cruel. Is it both?
It's both. And it's exploitive, of course. That is, you hear this repeatedly. It's repeatedly reflected in the interviews that are contained in this book. Folks saying, look, I work hard. I'm a good employee. I work 40 hours a week, or I work more than 40 hours a week, or sometimes I work two jobs. And yet people know that you can't pay for housing and electricity and transportation and childcare on $8 an hour, $8.50 an hour in Charlotte, North Carolina.
So what kind of jobs are they doing for that amount of money?
They are doing astonishingly in large numbers home health care. So for the wealthier of us, they are taking care of our parents and our grandparents in what can be grueling, but is also obviously vital and inspiring work. They are working in restaurants and at the grocery stores. They're working construction. Sometimes they're sitting beside us in our church pews. They are in, at the same time, long lines at food pantries so that they can help feed their children. What folks we interviewed low-income people, clients of Crisis Assistance Ministries, which I hate to keep mentioning, but you should know what a marvel that outfit is in Charlotte. I know you're aware of them. We interviewed about 15 low-income, mostly all women, over the course of 2 years from Crisis Assistance Ministry. And what they would say first is, they wouldn't put it this way because they're not rude, but they say, it's the wages, stupid. I work long hours. I've had hardly any raise over the course of the last 6 years. I'm a good employee. Yet people know that you're living right at the edge of desperation if you're making $8 an hour, $9 an hour, and they think that that's okay. These folks that we interviewed over that long period of time and got to know real well were astonishingly strong, hardworking, resilient, unbelievably committed to their families. They're kind of the opposite of the predisposition that you hear. Let me just say this. While we were interviewing them over that two-year period, all of them working very hard trying to make ends meet, the legislature first made moves which eliminated them from getting health care by refusing to expand Medicaid. Then about halfway into the interviews, the legislature dramatically cut the state's modest subsidy for child care so that those folks lost health care, and then they were told, I'm working 50 hours a week, but now my child care bill is going to go from $150 a month to $400 a month. I don't have that extra $300.
Yeah, you're also right about people who are on the cusp of moving into a new bracket, so to speak. And if they get a raise, they may be getting a subsidy for child care. They get this raise of $50 a month or whatever it is, and that disqualifies them for the money that they're getting for child care, and suddenly they can't afford child care, so they can't work the extra hours or they can't do the job anymore.
And folks in social services will tell them, well, if you want to keep getting your child care subsidy, you ought to quit your job. Now, those women in Charlotte at Crisis Ministries, they say, I'm not falling into that trap. The last thing in the world I want is to lose my job. I'm not going to make any progress if I don't work. So it's sort of opposite of the predisposition. Here's another example. A couple years ago, our legislature passed a law requiring drug testing for folks getting work first, at least an array of them. The guy who introduced it in the state legislature says because people who are getting this modest welfare program, they're laying out, taking drugs, and abusing the system. So they go through a pilot effort, which was mandated by the statute. That pilot reviews the first year's testing. It uncovered, I think it was 1.5% of folks tested positively, far short of, I told them, God, you ought to go up onto the Chapel Hill campus and test for drugs. You're not going to get 1.5% in your review. When they reported on this, the drug testing program, of course, had cost a ton. It had yielded virtually nothing. And the guy who introduced it, to his credit, said, well, this is not what I thought. And not what people in the legislature thought. We all believed that everybody on these welfare programs is hanging out, abusing the system, taking drugs. So it turns out not to be the case, and I'm glad to learn it. Then he was asked, or we sort of pressed, well, are you going to end the drug testing program? And of course, he didn't go into this, but the answer is no, because it's still serving its purpose. It's humiliating low-income people by making them pee in this cup. So whether it's actually saving us money or not doesn't matter.
There's also an element, as you write, of there but for the grace of God go I in many of these people's stories. You say that food bank workers see a lot of formerly prosperous people turning to handouts because of a mishap that has some way derailed their lives. What kinds of mishaps can lead a formerly prosperous individual into poverty? And are these temporary situations? Are they because of a lack of personal responsibility, a lack of planning? How can this happen?
Well, sometimes, you know, it's hard to
Every case is different.
It's hard to characterize the entirety of North Carolina, but large numbers of folks, and, you know, we know this, the recession taught us a little bit. A lot of people lost their homes through certainly no challenge of their own, just through the corruption of Wall Street, to be candid, who then continues to get bailed out. They have gone then from living sort of at the edge through low income, but solid low income work, to poverty level wages. Think about this. North Carolina's added a lot of jobs, and that's terrific. Our unemployment rate is much better than it was. It's not as good as the national rate, but it's much better than it was some short years ago. By the same token, We have the second highest level of poverty wage employment. And what people mean by that is a wage which won't take you out of poverty for a family of four under the federal standard. So roughly that means people making under $24,000, $25,000 a year. We have a lot of jobs. That's terrific because there's no better poverty program, anti-poverty program, than a good, decent paying job. But huge numbers of our jobs are, so they pay such meager wages that they can't allow a person to move out of poverty. Mm. That split is very obvious in Charlotte, where since the recession, fortunately, there have been a lot of jobs created which are amply compensated. Charlotte has probably a higher percentage of people making over $100,000 a year than the rest of the state. By the same token, very large percentages of those new jobs are poverty-level wages, service sector jobs, and a tiny, distressingly small percentage are middle income, what typically is viewed as like $45,000 to $60,000 a year. That middle category, upon which so much of American life depends, has been dropping precipitously. So in Charlotte, but in our other major urban areas too, we have increased poverty, increased child poverty, increased concentrated poverty. More and more poor people living together in close proximity under tough circumstances, which is a real challenge. And it's becoming increasingly racialized. So these are real challenges for us to deal with. Yeah. We're not going to deal with them by ignoring them.
And you believe that we have an obligation to do something about this. But is this a government problem? Is it a societal problem? Is it a problem of employers not paying a living wage? Because if they do, then they have to raise their prices and the rest of us won't buy their products. Is it a problem of our not being willing to expand Medicaid and expand the Affordable Care Act, therefore covering a lot of people who cannot get health insurance through their employer? This seems to be all of those and more.
It is all of those and more. And we certainly don't need an array of government policies which pile on and make them worse. But here's what I'd say. Spending the last 10 years a lot in low-income communities in North Carolina, I reached four kind of conclusions. First, the level of hardship which is experienced by our sisters and brothers is far more potent than people understand. And that's what a lot of this book is. Poverty and its challenges are far worse. Secondly, and I've written a lot about this, though we haven't talked about it today, amazingly, in every community, every county, every hamlet of North Carolina, there are people engaged in selfless, charitable, often religious-driven work, which is astonishing. It is so selfless that it makes people like me feel like a schmuck. The way I put it, if Mother Teresa were alive today, she would not be lonely in North Carolina. Hmm. Third, every one of those people would say that no matter how much work they do, no matter how hard they stretch, they cannot meet the gulf between what is demanded and what can be supplied. If they were Augustinians, they would say that charity cannot make up for the want of justice. And fourth, every one of those folks, if we could get them here in the room, would say it's getting worse, not better. That's a formula for real challenge for the state of North Carolina, and it's not a formula for silence.
Wow. You, in fact, say that we are failing radically in helping the poor. Wow.
Well, I wish it weren't true, but I don't think anyone who looks at it concludes otherwise.
G. Nickel is the Boyd Tinsley Distinguished Professor of Law at UNC Chapel Hill and for several years helped run the UNC Poverty Law Center with a group of students until that ended, I think, in 2015.
15, right.
His book is called The Faces of Poverty in North Carolina, Stories from Our Invisible Citizens. I have 10 seconds. Do you have hope?
I do have hope. I have hope in major part because of the growing number of folks who are paying attention to this and trying to demand that others do the same.
And let me stop you there, but thank you so much for the time. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.